supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show about wildlife today for you, cats and kittens. Question of the week is going to be about proper feeding of the birds, and we're also going to talk to somebody from the National Wildlife Federation about their program to get you certified as a wildlife habitat. Isn't that great? That's a lot to do, so we better start taking your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jeremy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. Jeremy, where are you, man?
In Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
One of my favorite places. We tore that place up in the spring when I visited. I love it there.
Oh, wonderful.
What can we do for Jeremy in Oklahoma City?
I'm calling today about my lawn not being so beautiful. I'm becoming an unintentional expert in growing dandelions. And last year, I even harvested the dandelions and brewed them up and made a tea to feed the other plants. And, you know, it got moldy, so I didn't end up using it, but it is sitting there, and I'm going to test it out on some plants this summer. But I'm calling. I wanted to plant new fescue grass, but I also wanted to get rid of the dandelions organically, of course. I've read about using the corn gluten.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And no. I know that inhibits the growth of any seed, right?
Yeah, but dandelions are kind of a biennial. So
okay.
Yeah, that's not the best thing. Now, you're in Oklahoma where the summers are going to get blazing hot. So you will be preparing for your new lawn over the summer, and then you would install it at the last, like, heat wave. If I were talking to somebody in Pennsylvania, I'd say you'd be looking at August 15th. But in Oklahoma, I think you'd be looking at early September. See, that way the soil is warm enough for the seed to sprout dramatically fast. And then that cool season grass can grow in the fall, winter, and spring, and it'll be almost a year old by the time it has to endure an Oklahoma summer.
Okay.
Now, dandelions are a sign of compacted soil. So one thing you might want to do before you seed is to do a core aeration. That's where you rent a machine or hire somebody to come out, and they pull plugs out of the soil to relieve the compacted soil. That will make.
I read about something with that recently about just taking a pitchfork and kind of wiggling it.
Right. See, physics will tell you that will not relieve soil compaction because you have not removed any soil. If you take out plugs that represent 10% of your lawn or soil, then when they fill back in naturally, it's going to be much less compacted. If you just poke holes in the dirt, it's going to fill back in and be the same thing.
Okay.
So now, if you want to try to reduce your dandelions this spring and summer, you have a lot of options. There are many tools. If you search dandelion weeders online, there are many types of tools that allow you to stand up and put your foot down on a plunger, and then there's a little cage that surrounds the root and pops it right out of the soil. I believe one of these is called the hound dog for reasons that escape me. but I've seen many variations on them, and some of them are made of very high-quality metal and last for a long time. There are also water-powered weeders where you stick this long spike into the ground that's attached to your garden hose, and you flood the root area, making it really easy to pull the dandelion out, or sometimes it just pops out on its own. And finally, there are flame weeders, because I would advise you at the end of the season or even in the summer in Oklahoma, if dandelions start to go to seed, that's when you really want to be out there making sure that seed doesn't spread, because that could get into your new lawn. So what I want you to do is buy a small flame weeder. You'll see these online all over the place. They cost like $40. They're just a simple shepherd's hook. And on one end, you attach a small camp stove size bottle of propane. And then get the ones with the automatic igniter. You hit the clicker, and a little flame comes out the other end. This is effective on a lot of weeds, but it is especially entertaining with dandelion puffballs. Because as soon as you get the flame near the puffball, the seeds will explode, and there's a riot of little colors in there. So it's like Munchkin fireworks.
Oh, great.
But if you take out some of the live plants, and then the remainders, you do your best to make sure that their seed doesn't disperse, and then you install your new lawn in September, you should hit the ground running, especially if you loosen up that soil first.
Okay.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks for your all the help today. That was wonderful.
All right. Thank you. You take care.
All right. You too.
1-888-346-9499. Mary Jane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Mary Jane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
And where is Mary Jane Fine?
Wayne, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Anybody ever call you MJ?
Yes.
Okay. You know, as soon as your name popped up on the screen, I thought, oh, yeah, Mary Jane Watson, Spider-Man's girlfriend. Actually, I think...
Yeah, I get a lot of different Mary Janes.
Yeah, I'll bet. All right, we'll stick with Spider-Man's girlfriend. What can we do for Mary Jane in Wayne, PA?
Well, last summer, or actually late spring, I planted about 12 azaleas and rhododendrons in the backyard. Babied those plants through the summer. They did fine through the fall. I look out one winter day, and they're down to sticks. Deer had come through and stripped them to bare bones. My question is, will they survive, or do I rip them out and start over?
Well, first of all, you did plant two of the most attractive things for deer. No, seriously.
No, I know. I have rhododendrons in the backyard, and they've never touched them. And they didn't touch the ones that were there, which I planted probably 8 years ago.
Yeah, but, you know, rhododendrons, as they age, they get kind of tough and woody. But any young plant in its first couple of years, even something like a holly that eventually is going to develop very sharp leaves, deer will eat it when they're young. And they love azaleas. So, obviously, you're not going to get any blooms this season.
I don't have any leaves. And
right.
That's my big question is, can it survive?
Well, yeah, because they're not doing photosynthesis over the winter. And there are some even deciduous azaleas that lose their leaves. So, what should happen is the plants, if they're still alive, will leaf out for you.
Okay.
But they probably won't be able to suck up enough energy to form flower buds for next year. But if they leaf out for you, they're alive, and in a cycle of about 2 years could begin to bloom. But you would need to protect them. Most of the time when people put out young plants like that, they'll just put metal cages around them for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
Which is
not very attractive, but
well,
does the job.
Years and years ago, I got lucky. I was in one of the big box home stores, and I needed welded wire fencing for my tomato plants, and came across these rolls of welded wire fencing. I believe they were from Italy, that were coated with a green plastic layer over the metal. And were advertised as being invisible. And it really is true. Once you put them up and they're surrounding the plants and there's some greenery around, you really don't see the cages.
Well, how high does it need to go? Because what's to keep them from just sticking their head over the side of the netting and attacking the plant?
Well, not so much netting as an actual cage.
Yeah.
Browse.
So it needs a top?
Well, browsing height is 32 to 36 inches. That's generally when deer don't have to bend down to eat something like a hosta, when they're going after a shrub. They almost always start within that range of 32 to 36 inches.
Oh,
so
okay.
A 5 foot high cage would make it difficult.
Okay.
Now, you could try deer repellents. You know, the most effective ones, the active ingredient is rotten eggs, essentially. And, you know, you won't smell it. But if you really saturate, especially a young plant, and the deer get a little taste of it, if it's very concentrated, they're going to go away. They're not going to...
Yeah, I looked out the backyard the other day, and I don't have a big property. There were 10 deer laying down in my yard. They were camped out.
Well, see,
so
you
somehow
know,
it's like a highway going through back there.
Really, the honest answer for deer problems is a professionally installed deer fence that's 8 feet high. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, but these are made of material that becomes invisible, really, to the naked eye. They are not an eyesore. But that's the only guaranteed way to keep deer off your property. And the smaller the property, the more cost-effective it becomes.
Right.
You just have to remember that you got to do the whole property and you got to put roller bars or something in the driveway.
Yeah, I live, the house is in the middle of a hill, so it would be kind of difficult because then you run into the problem of driveway and all that kind of stuff. I think the cages sound better. Does it need to have a top? Or can I just put it like a fence around the bushes?
Yes. If it's high enough, it doesn't need a top. I think five feet would be adequate.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, MJ.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Easttown Library in Berwyn, PA on Wednesday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. and at the Green Garden Fair in Cherry Hill, New Jersey on Saturday, May 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with details on certifying your habitat, strategic bird feeding, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will discuss a strategic tactic of bird feeding with a timing designed to get those birds to eat your garden pests. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to talk wildlife in general with our special guest, David Misijewski, who is a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation. He's been on the show before to talk about their fabulous backyard habitat program, how you can get a certified backyard habitat in your household and your landscape and your garden. And it's time to have him back again to talk about this very important topic. David, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me.
So is there anything new about the program which encourages homeowners to make their landscape friendly to the local wildlife?
I'm glad you asked that, because there is. The program name has changed. So back in the day, we used to call it the Backyard Wildlife Habitat Program, like you were just mentioning. But to be honest, over the years, we found that the potential audience for making these wildlife-friendly gardens was limited if we use that name, because people thought you had to have a suburban backyard. You could only do it in the backyard.
Right.
Believe it or not, I would get phone calls from people saying, I've got a great butterfly garden, but it's in my front yard. So
I don't count.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, come on, you guys, like, work with us here. We don't mean literally just backyard. So to address that, we changed the name of the program to the Garden for Wildlife program. We just wanted to make it a little bit more simple, a little bit more obvious what it was all about, and let people know that it doesn't matter where you are. If you have a big piece of yard, small property, maybe you don't even have your own garden space because you live in an apartment building. If you can plant something, you can do something good for wildlife. So that's why we call it the Garden for Wildlife program. But otherwise, it's the same. It's all about providing food and water and cover and places to raise young, managing your garden in a sustainable, natural way. And then if you do those things, the National Wildlife Federation will certify it as a certified wildlife habitat.
Okay, so I'm in an apartment building. How can I get certified?
Well, you do have to have...
At least in your way.
Yeah, you do have to have some sort of outdoor access, right? So a lot of people that live in apartments have, you know, say a little balcony. They might have access to the roof. If you don't have those things, most cities, there are great community garden communities that you could get connected in. Sometimes there's even, planter boxes near the curb or things like that. So that's where I would focus if you're living in an urban area and you want to help out the local wildlife, you want to attract really beautiful birds and butterflies. And again, if you can plant something, then you can be providing habitat, because let's face it, Mother Nature provides habitat for wildlife first and foremost through the plant community. And that's why the National Wildlife Federation, a wildlife conservation group, is in the garden business, because what we're trying to get people to do is restore those native plant communities or, mimic them in some way so that the wildlife will have that habitat. So yeah, if you're in a container situation or even a tree box in a city street, think about planting some drought-tolerant, native wildflowers that are going to provide nectar to butterflies and bees. Maybe there's some things that will get seed heads on them, like a simple purple coneflower. That's a great butterfly plant, bee plant, and bird plant for birds like goldfinches that want to come and eat the seed.
You know, it's funny, the emphasis on birds. One of the things I learned first when I was editor of Organic Gardening magazine in the 1990s was that the origins of the magazine in 1942, it was tough to get the word out to subscribers. And there were mailing lists at the time, but there weren't any mailing lists dedicated to people who wanted to garden without chemicals. So J.I. Rodale, the founder of Organic Gardening magazine and Rodale Press, which is Rodale Inc. today, tested a whole bunch of lists. And the only one that worked was bird watching groups.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. Listen, there's a reason I titled my book Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife, because people love birds. They want to see them. They want to know they're helping them. And a lot of the people that participate in the National Wildlife Federation's program, it's the same thing. I mean, they do it because they're their first introduction to this idea of urban, suburban wildlife, of urban ecology, of restoring native plant communities, all that good stuff, oftentimes is through just their simple love of birds. You know, if I called my book Attracting Toads and Snakes, probably no one would buy it, right?
But I would.
I'm happy to hear that, because those wildlife species also need our help.
The best outdoor personal experiences I've had with wildlife have been with toads.
Really?
I have a great relationship with my toads.
There's got to be a story there.
Oh, yeah. One year, soon after we bought our house, on every spring, summer evening, I noticed a little toad sitting right by the front door, and got to see him night after night, and finally thought, this guy should be in the garden. He should be eating my Mexican bean beetles,
right,
and slugs and stuff. So I picked him up, carried him over to the garden, put him in a nice raised bed that was damp and shady and everything. Next night, he shows up right by the front door. This literally went on for years. I mean, he would come back year after year, or a similar toad would come back year after year. Maybe it was the position of the house lights that made that a very attractive spot. But one year, he did not show up, and I was distraught. And my wife knew it right away. It was like, What's wrong? Oh, my toad's not back. He'll come back. Well, May turns to June, turns to July, and no toad, and I'm like kicking a can down the street with my eyes down. And then one night, I felt compelled to go out. I hadn't picked the string beans for ages, bush beans. And I go out, typical McGrath style. I've got like a pith helmet with a flashlight taped to the top. And I'm picking in complete darkness, and I push these bush beans aside, and inside is this huge toad, like 6 inches across.
Wow.
And he's got food in his mouth. He's eating the bean beetles. I wondered why our beans were so good that year. And he's just looking up at me and going, you know, you put me in here for years. You know, what do you want? Because later I found out that little toad became a big toad.
Yeah.
That there weren't all these different sized toads, but that they live for 12 years and they grow and grow and grow, and they eat their own weight in insect pests. So
absolutely.
If you keep a baby toad alive, they turn into a mean green bug eating machine.
Absolutely, yeah, no, and it's such a great topic because well, there's so much in there, right? So number one, beyond the world of the birds and the butterflies, the pretty stuff. One of our messages at the National Wildlife Federation is that there's lots of other really amazing, cool critters out there that not only could use our help. Amphibians like, you know, toads and frogs and salamanders are on the decline worldwide. So being able to help out one of that group of animals literally right in your own yard is kind of a powerful thing. But even more, a lot of times when I speak to garden groups, I meet up with gardeners whose first lesson was, you know, get rid of the wildlife, spray it, squash it, you know, banish it. And I always like to point out that, you know, honestly, you really can't have a productive, say, vegetable garden without wildlife. Because guess what? Those bees, those butterflies, those pollinators all count as wildlife.
So two things that you just mentioned that I'll follow up on. Amphibians, frogs, especially because frogs spend their entire life in water, whereby toads are only born in water. I shouldn't even say only. But the fear of mosquitoes, which is a rational fear, a more rational fear every year, has people doing things that endanger that water. So we have become big proponents of BTI, which you can get in dunks or granules, and you can put it in water. And the water is still perfectly safe, not only for frog and toad breeding, but lightning bug breeding. Birds can drink from that water. A fox can drink from that water. But no mosquitoes can breed in that water. And we warn people that this is the time of year to be ready to do this, because this is when the frogs and toads are beginning to breed. And it's also when the mosquitoes are starting to breed. And if you knock down that first generation of mosquitoes, you might not have any mosquitoes on your property that summer.
Yeah, no, it's a really timely subject, you know, with you know, Zika and other diseases that are mosquito borne that are making the news in these last couple of years. And so I mentioned those four components of habitat that we try to teach people about and what we encourage people to, you know, create in their yards or their gardens. Food. The second one is water. It's cover and places to raise young are the other two. But the water component is the one that I think often gives people the most trouble. Either they don't have a water source. You know, most people have, you know, some plants in their yard, right, that are providing some cover and some nesting spots or whatever. Most people are missing that water source. And then the first question that they have when they want to put it in is, well, what about mosquitoes? And what you were saying is absolutely right. We also at National Wildlife Federation recommend the BTI mosquito dunks.
Which we should point out right now is a totally natural compound. It's a naturally occurring soil organism.
That's right.
The only effect it has on anything on this planet is to prevent members of the fly family from successfully breeding in standing water. So the only thing you're taking out is mosquitoes, black flies, and those lousy little gnats that go for your eyes in the springtime.
That's exactly right.
When I give your kind of a talk, when I give a wildlife pollinator talk, one of the things I tell people, water can be really scarce in the summertime. And fresh water can be difficult for birds to find. So it's a real mitzvah to have a fountain or a little pool or a bird bath or a water feature.
Yeah, water is the real magnet for wildlife. That's what I always say for all of those exact reasons. You know, and you naturally think, you know, when it's hot out in the summer, you know, we need to put out the, you know, the bird bath or whatever, the garden pond, make sure that there's a water source. A lot of people don't think about the winter, though. You know, wintertime water can be really, really important.
And bath heater.
Yeah, you get a bird bath heater, or even, you know, if you don't want to go that route, just be low tech. go out every morning, dump the ice out of the birdbath, fill it up with, you know, room temperature water. It'll take a few hours for it to freeze. And no, you don't have to worry about the birds, you know, getting in the water and then freezing. It's, you know, it's okay. They get wet in nature. but yeah, absolutely. The water source is a real magnet, and a simple bird bath will do. It doesn't have to be, again, a big elaborate garden pond. Now, sure, if you have the space and the budget and electricity and all of that, if you want to do that, those are fabulous wildlife water features too. And that's where you might start attracting things
like
frogs,
dragonflies,
yeah, stuff like that. But don't feel obligated to do that. If you want to provide a water source, a bird bath will do. And one last tip on bird baths, you know, you can put mosquito dunks or granules in them too.
Or just wash them out once
exactly.
a week.
Exactly. That's just the thing. Mosquitoes take about a week to hatch into their aquatic larval form before they go through metamorphosis and turn into the winged adults, right? So all you got to do is dump out your bird bath every 2, 3, 4 days.
Yeah,
and if there's any eggs or mosquito larvae in there, that you know, they go down the drain. But I want to go back to bird feeders, because again, you hit on some really important messages and points. I always say that bird feeders are really more for people than they are
they're
for
totally.
Birds.
They're totally. They're like an outdoor television set.
Totally. And there's actually nothing wrong with that. As long as you're, you know, feeding in moderation. You know, sometimes I hear from people who have a quarter acre and they've got 50 bird feeders. That's unnatural. That's going to cause crowding. It could spread disease, things like that. So, you know, one or two feeders in a typical yard is totally fine. It allows you a good, you know, regular spot where you know the birds are going to show up, that you can see and enjoy them. You know, again, you want to keep your feeders clean. They can pass disease if you don't disinfect them periodically. You don't want the seed to go mildewy or moldy. If you have hummingbird feeders, same thing. You want to empty those every few days, really, if the hummingbirds aren't drinking the nectar. But yeah, the birds are only using those feeders as a supplement to the natural foods that they find out in the landscape, which underscores, again, the importance of your plants.
Now, at the National Wildlife Federation's website, I presume you have lots of suggested plantings for wildlife. Do you break it down by region of the country? I mean, because, you know, wildflower out west could be a pest here or something.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I think the gardening public is pretty well aware these days of the concept of native plants, you know, the plants that naturally evolved in your ecoregion. However, it does bear saying that the United States, for example, is a very big geographic and ecological place. So to your point, something that, you know, is native in California is not native in Vermont just because they're all from North America. So yeah, you want to think about what's naturally growing in your ecoregion. A lot of nurseries nowadays are carrying native plants, or at least cultivars of them. And so yeah, on our website, we've got a ton of resources on plants, on all four of those components of habitat that I've been mentioning: food, water, cover, places to raise young. And that's also where you go if you want to apply to have your yard or garden recognized.
And what do you get?
As a certified wildlife
habitat.
What
do you get? Do you get a plaque? Do you get one of those yards? Signs?
Yeah. So when you certify, really, honestly, it's our way of thanking folks, and folks generally like to get a little bit of recognition from, you know, a big national conservation organization. And what you get is you get a personalized certificate with, you know, your name on it. You can name your habitat. You get an individualized habitat number. We've got over 200,000 of them over the course of the program, over 40 years. So that's, you know, a good number of them. But, you know, it's really, you know, you're joining this group of like-minded individuals who are wanting to do something good for wildlife. You also get a free one-year membership to the National Wildlife Federation, which gets you a subscription to the award-winning National Wildlife Magazine, every issue of which has some articles in it that are relevant to, you know, backyard wildlife and birds and, you know, native plants and things like that. And you get a 10% discount to National Wildlife Catalog, where we sell a whole bunch of, you know, wildlife gardening stuff, bird baths, and we do have some feeders, nesting boxes. I actually work with our catalog team to pick all of those products to make sure that they're
so
actually...
So the nesting boxes are good. Yes. They don't have the little predator perch on the outside and everything like that. They're the right size for the job.
So I can personally vouch for all of those products, that they're going to be good, they're going to be quality, they're actually going to help the wildlife. So you get a 10% discount when you certify to that, and you become eligible to get one of our yard signs, which is an extra fee, which goes right back into our program. Mm-hmm. It funds us. It helps keep our doors open. So it's a really kind of fun, powerful act of conservation that you're going to be rewarded by seeing all the animals. And yes, you'll get a little pat on the back from us. And at the end of the day, know that you're doing something good.
And I'll remind everybody that the core of any program like this is don't use pesticides.
Yes.
Don't attract pollinators. and then kill them. You know,
that's exactly right. And that's another thing that is, you know, new-ish to our program. Probably about 10, 12 years ago, we added a fifth requirement if you want to get certified. So in addition to providing those four habitat components, we also want people to be doing what we call quote-unquote sustainable gardening. All that means is natural gardening. You know, if you read Organic Gardening Magazine, you know what we're talking about. And so it is not using pesticides, but also other things like trying to practice water conservation. So, you know, if you live in a desert environment, maybe don't plant a lawn, right? Maybe go with a xeriscape concept.
Yeah, and do gray water.
Yeah, exactly. Do gray water. Even if you don't live in an arid area, use rain barrels. Save, you know, rainwater. Use that in the garden rather than the municipal water source.
All right. We have been talking with David Misiejewski, naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation, about their kind of new backyard habitat program. It is a great program. We recommend it highly. So look them up. They're at the – what's the website, David?
So it's NWF, as in National Wildlife Federation, nwf.org/garden. And we've got tons of tips and projects and ideas, videos. That's where you go to get certified. It's where you can order my book. All of it's there, nwf.org/garden.
All right, David, thanks for being back on the show.
Absolutely, thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will present a Titanic talk on tomatoes on Saturday, May 13th, during the big annual plant sale at the Seed Farm in Emmaus, PA, which is in the Lehigh Valley. And then I'll return to the Lehigh Valley to go to the Allentown Library for an appearance on Wednesday, May 24th at 7 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with a discussion of strategic bird feeding and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Could it possibly be bad to feed your birds? Or maybe it's only bad at certain times of the year, and maybe there's some feeding you can do that will negate your insect pest problems. We'll investigate all those fascinating ideas after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hello there.
Well, hello there back to you, Michelle. How are you?
Well, I am well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm hanging on by a thread, Michelle.
Well, hang on. Hang on to that branch.
Yeah. Where are you?
I am on the outskirts of Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, that's a great place. Yeah, I haven't been there for way too long. You got to get that radio station to bring me back down there.
Hey, we love our radio station. I used to do a garden show on this radio station.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So maybe you'll put on a different hat and answer your own question now. What can we do for Michelle in Nashville?
Well, we have a problem area. It's a large space, and we want to make a shrub and flower bed. And it in a sunny space, very sunny, there's a brick wall behind it that's part of a garage. And there's two big problems. One, we think that it's totally filled with Bermuda grass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst. And we've been digging it up and dug out 3 30-gallon trash bags, but we know there's still more, and the roots are under there.
Right.
And then the other problem is that the soil is like 7.58 or on the sweet, very sweet side.
You know, I would expect that from our listeners in Oklahoma, not necessarily Nashville. That's a very high alkalinity.
Yeah, this is a new area where I think they took the topsoil away, and we're dealing with subsoil that's a lot of clay and just whatever.
Okay. Well, you got a couple of choices. I mean, honestly, especially considering the time of year and the fact that you tell me it's full sun, I don't know if you're willing to do this, but if you would give up this growing season, you could solarize the soil. That would kill the Bermuda grass, and it might bring the pH down. You know, you don't have to bring it down that much. It's not like it's 10 or anything. You just got to bring it down to like 6.5. But solarization would definitely kill those tenacious rhizomes in Tennessee in full sun over the course of a season.
That's a good idea, but everybody's impatient. And they want me to plant like shrubs and flowers yesterday.
Right. If it was just a smaller flower bed, I would say, you know, host a pulling party, you know, do a little barbecue, buy the good beer, and really saturate that area for a full day beforehand and have everybody come over and pull their own weight in Bermuda grass before the cooler gets opened.
Uh-huh.
That's one option. Another option, if you wanted to keep the Bermuda grass as a ground cover, carve holes into it and plant in containers, but only about halfway. So the container is half in the soil and half in the air. And then you could have the Bermuda grass around to accent the plants, and you wouldn't have to go to a lot of work, and it wouldn't smother the plants in the containers.
Okay.
But the honest answer, if you really want to be rid of it and start this thing over, would be soil solarization, which, as you probably know, means you would till up the area, level it, saturate it with water, cover it with clear plastic, and really hammer the edges of that plastic down nice and tight. And by the end of the summer, anything in that bed would be dead. Any weed seeds, any disease, any rhizomes. But the crazy thing about soil solarization is the research has shown that after you take the plastic off, the life in the soil multiplies dramatically. And after a season, you wind up with more diversity of microbial life in your soil than you did before the solarization. Nobody knows why, but it really improves your soil as it gets rid of all kinds of problems.
Okay, well, that's good. But if we wanted to plant it this year, I've heard about using vinegar sprays and stuff, but I think that plants have to be actively growing, and I fear that as much as we pull out, there will be some hiding roots under there, and they will come back and haunt us.
You can try horticultural vinegar. You must wear eye protection. You must make sure there are no other people or pets in the area. You know, it's non-toxic, but it could be dangerous if you get it in your eyes. This would be a tough weed to defeat with herbicides, again, because that deep rhizomatic root system can store lots of nutrients.
Yes.
You know, you could meet it halfway and use it as your ground cover around containerized plants, or even plants that are fitted into the ground surrounded by really high-quality edging, or have the pulling party, or do the soil solarization. But I don't think attacking it with any kind of an herbicide is going to be effective.
Well, that's fine, because I would rather not do that.
Okay, Michelle?
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. You take care and good luck.
Well, you too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, it's This is Mike from Olochapoca, Alabama, a little town outside of Auburn, Alabama.
How do you say that again, Mike?
Olochapoca. It's a Creek Indian name. It has something to do with turtles, but nobody's been able to really define it.
All right. What can we do for Mike in Alabama?
Well, I have this girlfriend. She's a PhD in botany, and she has an organic farm, and she makes beautiful plants, and mine look terrible compared to hers. So I thought, after listening to your show and you touting how great raised beds are, I thought, well, I'll try that because it's too much trouble getting a PhD in botany. So I went to the store and bought 42 concrete blocks. That allows me to make a 4x24 perimeter. And the cool thing about a concrete block, it's got two openings in it that you can use as flower pots also. So I have 84 little pots around my garden spot. But my question's about the soil mix. And so I can get about 2 cubic yards of the mix in there. So per cubic yard, 27 cubic feet. My soil would be how many cubic feet? And I'll tell you about my soil. It's a heavy clay, and when it gets a little bit of loam, but when it rains, it packs and gets crusty, and you got to bust it up to where the plant can breathe.
Gotcha.
So I got to really, really loosen it up. So I bought some peat moss, and I bought some mushroom compost and some vermiculite. And I just wondered how many cubic feet of each of those would you guess would be in my recipe with my native soil?
Okay, so you've outlined the bed with the concrete blocks.
Right.
One of the reasons we build raised beds is to avoid your native soil. So what I'm going to suggest to you is run a tiller, which I normally don't suggest to people, but I know the kind of soil you're talking about. I would run a tiller inside that area just to bust everything up, get some good drainage in there. But then I would level it out, and I would put the mixture on top. Now, you will find the tilling will raise the level of soil already. So the ideal mixture for a raised bed really is half compost, which is different than mushroom soil, and half screen black topsoil, with vermiculite, which you already have, or perlite added for drainage. And I, generally recommend them 50-50. So now, what kind of mushroom soil do you have? Is it fresh and hot, or is it aged and cool?
Well, it's in a bag. I bought it at a store, and it just says mushroom compost.
Oh.
I haven't even opened it and looked at it. But
okay. How many bags did you buy?
I got 4 bags right now, and 4 bags of topsoil, and I bought 4 cubic yards of vermiculite and 4 cubic yards of peat moss.
Okay.
And not yards, feet.
Well, it's okay. I can't do math. what I want you to do is open up one of the bags of mushroom compost and give it the duck test. You're going to smell it, you're going to look at it, and you're going to put some in your hand and make a fist and see what it does. If it has any kind of an off smell, you want to return that to the store. Bagged compost can be very iffy. Most times people will get some bulk compost from their municipality or from a garden center. But if it's okay, that's fine. Topsoil in a bag can be really risky. Again, you got to take that out, pour it out in the sun, and see what color it is when it's dry. And again, return it to the store if it has any kind of off smell. Or if once exposed to light and drying out, it turns tan, and then it's just lousy clay soil. Vermiculite is probably as good as perlite for loosening up the soil. The peat moss is okay, but if you're going to use peat moss, you have to add some wood ash or lime to it to negate the acidity. Although those big bricks from Canada tell you, you can use it anywhere, it really does make soil acidic. But you can counteract that with some agricultural lime or some wood ash.
Okay. Well, my last question here is about the height of the soil mixture. I'm 1 block high, which means I'll have about 7.5 inches of soil. If I added another block, would that be more ideal, or am I okay with just that level?
Adding another block would be beyond ideal. The more raised the bed and the more loose kind of soil mix you have in there, the better your results are going to be. 7 inches is kind of below my minimum. I like it to be at least 1 foot, but if you do a second block up top, you're also going to find the stuff is going to be much easier to reach. You won't have to bend over as far. And again, yeah, I did this years ago. I had a couple of beds made of concrete blocks, and I did exactly what you were saying. I planted marigolds in all of the block holes, and it looked great.
Yeah, all right. Well, I sure appreciate your advice there. I can get to work now and get her going.
You're going to find that even if you have to maneuver things a little bit sideways in the future, you're going to find the results from raised beds are beyond belief.
Well, I know my girlfriend's plants turn mine to shame, so and she does that. So,
yep.
I'm looking forward to that.
Get out of that flat earth and get up in the air, and you'll be amazed.
Great.
All right, take care, sir. Good luck. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Selective feeding is better for your birds and you. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Paula in Cinnaminson, New Jersey writes, when should I stop putting suet in my feeders? I've filled them up all winter and have had lots of wanted visitors. And the squirrels have mostly been defeated by a greased pole. But should I still be filling the feeders now that it's getting warmer? The birds are still stopping by. Should I gradually stop? Any advice?
Lots of advice, Paula. Now, suet feeders are metal cages that hold little cakes of rendered fat. Once upon a time, they had to come down when the weather got warm because the suet would melt and it could get on the birds' feathers. But modern suet cakes, which often have treats like nuts and dried berries mixed in, resist melting much better, and they can be left up later in the spring. Oh, and there are also suet cakes that are, quote, flavored with hot pepper powder, and they can also help keep those evil squirrels at bay.
Hot pepper? Won't that hurt the birds?
Just the opposite. Birds don't experience any burning sensation. And hot peppers are a great food source for them, especially in the winter, when some experts suspect it helps them feel warmer. And a generous dose of hot pepper shake in a seed feeder will also deter evil squirrels from that favorite food source and supply much-needed nutrients for those birds.
But, Mike, you've been advocating not feeding birds with seed for years.
Right. Still do. And I suspect that Paula is picking up on some of those past conversations, as she's pretty much describing my method. Put out lots of suet feeders in the fall, keep them filled over the winter, and then stop in the spring. Suet attracts meat-eating birds that are great at controlling insect pests, like the chickadee, titmouse, nutthatch, and all kinds of wonderful woodpeckers.
So the birds choose this food-rich area for their nesting sites over winter and then switch to eating insect pests in the spring when the suet feeders become empty.
It's a plan that has worked well for us for years. We have not put out any kind of food in the summer for decades, and our landscape is a riot of birds, especially this time of year when they're choosing mates and putting on great aerial displays. Oh, and speaking of mating, a very interesting article published a few years back in The Economist reported that Swiss researchers found that supplemental feeding interfered with mating. It made some male birds so, quote, lazy that they didn't start putting on their mating displays until long after the prime females had already been courted.
And there are fears that supplemental feeding could interfere with young birds' abilities and instincts to find food in the wild.
Yep, the Humane Society says that, quote, birds don't need your help in the summer when they're nesting and rearing their young, and instead they're going to focus on eating insects. It is also important, they continue, for young birds to learn how to find naturally occurring foods. And so their advice, take a break from filling feeders in the summer. Bird feeding is most helpful in the late winter and early spring when natural seed sources are depleted.
And more important to organic gardeners, if you are feeding the birds, they're not eating your insect pests. And those birds can eat a lot of pests, right? Especially when they're nesting because they need the extra protein to feed their young.
Absolutely. When we did a special section on beneficial birds back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I learned that many birds who are thought of as strictly seed eaters switch to insects when they're rearing their young to get that extra high energy food.
Ah, but there is something gardeners should do for their birds in the summer.
Absolutely. Natural food is abundant in the summer, but fresh water can be scarce. I see this displayed dramatically every year in the stream that runs right next to our house. In the spring, it's a miniature raging whitewater, but it's often bone dry in July and August. And that dry time is when bird baths can really help our winged wonders.
And you tell people to put those bird baths right in the center of the garden so the birds can scan your plants for tasty insects as they fly in and out.
And here's a new bird-helping suggestion. When I recently spoke in Fayetteville, I stayed with some family friends. Hello, Hannah and Adam. And I spent a lot of time in their backyard. The weather was amazing. They had only recently moved into this house, and the, quote, lawn out there had some bare spots that were very dry and dusty. So while I'm sitting out there, I must have seen four different birds fly down and roll around on those patches to give themselves a little dirt bath. I think they do it to get rid of mites. It was a much better show than they would have put on at a feeder.
Speaking of feeders, when should the suet stop?
You know, essentially now, this time of year, even a few weeks ago, when the weather is warm enough that you see insects in the air. That's when the birds can move seamlessly from suet to flying pest. Well, those sure were some interesting ideas about feeding the birds, now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put a squirrel feeder in my backyard if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you really can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you will find the answers to all those garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Special thanks to David from the National Wildlife Federation for coming into the studio today. To learn more about their certified habitat and other programs, visit nwf.org. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz make our website certified. Our intrepid intern, Michael Inglés, has augmented our habitat, but as is the way of all interns, must leave us to go back to school. Best of luck, Michael. We will miss you. Our production assistant is Brett the Viking Raider. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, she thinks I should be certified. Wild and untamed Al Banks is our editor. I'm For the Birds, Mike McGrath, and I'll wing my way back to see you, maybe eat some of your bad bugs, next week. International Compost Awareness Week is coming up. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll help raise some of that awareness by discussing how to interpret professional test results and how you can test compost without a lab, plus your fabulous phone calls.